Welcome, those of you in the room and those of you online. And as you can see, we're doing a course called Presenting the Path, and we're up to class three. We'll begin as we normally do by taking refuge, generating the mind of enlightenment. We'll say a few other prayers. We'll actually engage in the teaching. And within the teaching, there's areas for questioning and also for meditation. So let's begin, which means it requires that you guys first get comfortable in your seats. This means place your hands and feet wherever they feel most comfortable. Drop your shoulders. So straighten your back, your spine. Now close your eyes or keep them slightly open. Just let your body breathe itself. So while your body is breathing itself, be aware of the movements that it takes when you inhale and exhale, and what those movements feel like. So if there is any tightness or tension that you can feel in the body as it breathes itself, imagine just releasing it with every exhalation. And with the release of this tension, allow the body to relax completely. And feeling at ease and comfortable in your seat, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light, and he is sitting on a throne of gold. He is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, along with meditational deities, Arahants, and protectors. Surrounding you are all sentient beings. These include your parents, brothers and sisters, and other family members. People who've had difficulties and misunderstandings with, and strangers. And you recollect that what we have in common with one another is a wish to avoid suffering, a wish to be happy, and a wish to be happy. But we all equally lack genuine happiness. Now, this lack of genuine happiness is caused by suffering and its causes. Well, these can be eliminated, and the potential for genuine happiness within us can be released. So, to dispel the causes of suffering and to actualize this genuine happiness, we have to abandon many different forms of attachment. Some of them are to the fantasies of this life, others are to the pleasures of psychic existence. We have attachment to our own singular welfare, and we have a belief in an independent and objective reality. These are all objects of abandonment, and it's possible for us to abandon them, thereby accomplishing our own welfare and being in a position to benefit everyone else. But I think that you wish to develop your wisdom, your compassion, and every other skill that you have to benefit all living beings. And it's possible to do this because you know of others who've done it. You know they relied upon different texts, upon their realizations, they had a spiritual community, and we have all of these things. Now, what's most important is for us to acknowledge that the mind itself has no true existence. Therefore, it can be changed. So, the suffering that we experience now can be ended. And the potential for this genuine happiness that we have can be released. to do this, we need to rely upon those who have brought about that release, their teachings and themselves as a community. So let's decide to go for refuge to those beings and their teachings. And join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, think that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream forth. And these wash over ourselves and all the people surrounding us. And our attachments are set free. If we relax and at ease, and we recollect four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, we decide to develop these ourselves and to establish all beings in those states. So we say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in their community, free from the vast attachments for friends and hatred for enemies. It all accomplishes. We recollect that we need our help to accomplish this goal. So we recollect the field of merit above us. We prepare ourselves to purify the mind a little more, to accumulate merit and then to increase it. And so we say to the field of enlightened beings above us, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for the good beings. I dedicate my own other merits to its great enlightenment. So, to prevent us from having attachment to the states of purification, we've accomplished for ourselves and the merit we've accumulated. Recollect emptiness and dependent arising and acknowledge that all phenomena exist in mere name. And this name depends upon consciousness. So think that your body, speech and mind, what we call the external world, everything vanishes within the sphere of emptiness. And then reappears as a pure land. And we're going to offer this to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the spiritual community for our sake and the sake of all beings. So we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirred with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents of southern India. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnamana Kamaya Tayami. So release the offering, and the Buddha accepts it and he looks at us. And looking into our eyes, he smiles. And meeting his gaze, we feel accepted and at ease, as if all of our requests have been acknowledged and accepted. Then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space and comes to the body bound to the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. And now this emanation starts to descend down to the level of your heart, whereupon it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. You pour out through the pores of the skin, and begin to fill the 10 directions of space with light and nectar, thereby establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And within that space, you hear the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha resounding. And you join in, saying, Tayatami Mahamudaya Tayatami Mahamudaya Tayata Omri Uri Mahamunaya Soha. You're following under your breath a few times. And the light rays and nectar back from the 10 directions of space into your heart. And you feel the seat beneath you, and you can hear the sounds. You acknowledge this meditation has been one of imagination. It's imprinted the mind with the potential for you to fully awaken for the benefit of all sentient beings. And you rejoice in that. And you just pretend, I still want to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. And I will be. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter. Okay, let's have a look at what we've covered. Well, we began our first class looking at Buddhist history. Then last week we looked at the 12 deeds and the benefits of listening. You know, the three wrong ways to listen and the six beneficial attitudes to adopt when you listen. Today's topics, we're going to look at some of the some lam rim overviews. What are called the three preliminaries before actually engaging in studies of the path, and then the aims, motives, and practices of a novice or a beginner in terms of the path. I've relied upon these books here and others for the material. So the first book here, called A Teacher's Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, is a commentary by Geshe Rinchen on this particular text. I'll say more about the text shortly. Gradual Awakening by Miles Neal is a commentary on what they call the three principal aspects of the path. And this last one here, Tsongkhapa, Preparing for Tantra, is a commentary on the foundation of all good qualities. Now, all of these texts will be talked about over the next few weeks, probably quite briefly, but the verses will be used from some of them. These two middle texts here, material that shows how you sort of engage through the different practices of the path. Those are small scope, middle scope, and great scope. Now, all of Buddhist lam rim texts, so a lam rim is just a text, it's a way of, in English, it's stages of a path to enlightenment, stages of a path. They all come from one text. They're all the foundational texts. It's a text called A Lamp for the Path, by Lama Atisha. This Lamp for the Path is just made up of 68 verses. The author, of course, is Lama Atisha. And it was composed in Western Tibet at the Tolin Temple, which still exists as the picture of it. It was written in the mid-11th century. Now, this text was written in response to the request of a king of Tibet at that time. He asked Atisha for a teacher that anyone could practice, and Atisha composed this text called The Lamp. Now, the lamp itself, like I said, is made up of 68 verses. The first two verses are what they call preliminaries, and there's one verse that just is a homage, And the other one is a brief summary of everything we're going to have a look at. Then the actual teaching itself is made up of these 65 verses. And here Lama Atisha introduces us to the concept of the three capacities of a spiritual person. So he says, when we first begin, we have small capacity or small scope. And in this text, there's only one verse given to it. Then it says that once you sort of know how to practice as a beginner, there are other practices you can do, which are called a practice for a person of middling capacity or middling scope. And here, once again, he just has one verse. And all the rest of it is practices for the person of great scope. Then the whole thing finishes off with just one verse, and it's a verse of making a final request. Now, all these Lamrim texts are sort of set out very similar to this. There's always three parts. The middle part is always the main thrust of the teaching. But they always begin with something like a homage or a brief tell you, give you a good idea of what this thing's about. At the very end is some sort of dedication thing. This text, like I said, is a foundational text for all the different Lamrims that follow. So in the Nyingma tradition, they have Lamrims. They're all sort of following the same thing, the Sakya, the Kagyu, and the Galupa. Now, in the Galupa, there are many different Lamrim texts written by many different authors. Here, we're just going to focus on the ones done by Lama Tsongkhapa. And he basically presented the Lamrim in three different ways over time. So this is called what they call the Great Lamrim Chenmo. So this only came out not too long ago, like 20 years ago, maybe a flat, in English. So it's a modern sort of thing. And as you can see, it's one of these three books, is about 1,500 pages altogether, something like that.
When you say it only just came out, it's a Lama Tsongkhapa text.
Yes.
Do you mean the translation became available?
Yes, in English.
Only recently.
Yes, that's right. Okay. The complete translation became available to all of us only recently, 20 years ago. So this is a massive sort of encyclopedia. There's lots of logic and debate and all sorts of things in there. If anybody's ever tried to read this, especially when you come to the section on wisdom, like, well, you have to sort of go, I don't get it. That's what normally happens. And you really, it's really, really helpful here to have somebody explain it to you. And in fact, when we did this text many years ago, yeah, it took a long time up at CI. In fact, we've nearly finished it here, and it's taken us 10 years to do it as a group of students. And it's the second time we've gone through it. We've nearly finished it. And when we begin again, I want to go through this one, the Middling Lamrim. This is, you can see, just one volume, and it's quite a lot different than the Great Lamrim. It's got stuff material in there that is definitely not in the Great Lamrim, especially material on the two truths. In the Great Lamrim, Lama Tsongkhapa sort of his main aims at a couple of different philosophers who he thinks are completely mistaken. When it comes to the middle, he tackles another two philosophers. There's different ways of getting at each philosopher. Like I said, the major difference here is this idea of having the two truths. There's a very good explanation there. As you can see, this one is much briefer. Then this is what they call the concise Lamrim. So it's just got 45 verses. In other words, it's even shorter than Lama Ratish's Lamp for the Path. Now, all three of these texts share the same three-level goal that Lama Tsongkhapa first introduced in terms of first of the small scope, middling scope, and great scope. It suggested that when we sort of study, we can use the Great Lamrim to solve our doubts, because in that text, they raise doubt after doubt after doubt. And when I studied it, this was really sort of, I had not much patience with that, but it's hard enough to even understand what's going on. Then they raise all these doubts, and you don't even understand what the doubt is. But then, for another 10 years, and then now the doubt's the most interesting part of it. So my mind has changed over time. What I said in the beginning, it's really difficult to understand what the heck, what is the doubt, all that sort of stuff, right? That's why it's very, very useful to have a lama, a Geshe in particular, to break the whole thing down, to actually explain it to you. And of course, we do need a good translator too. Now, all these texts have something in common, and what they're called is the three preliminary contemplations. And these three preliminary contemplations are done in quite an extensive way in the great, much more concise than here. And the second one is like a couple of sentences. That's it, done. So let's have a look at what these three preliminary contemplations are. The first is what they call the greatness of the author or the teacher. The idea behind this is to establish that the source is authentic. And so what happens, especially in the great Lamrim, we get an extensive biography of a teacher. Because they said, all the other Lamrims all come from Lama teachers. Second thing that's in all these texts is what they call the greatness of the teacher, which is, of course, the Dharma. And here they present logical justifications of why the system is complete and the very best type of system. And finally, we get this section called How to Listen to and Explain the Teachings. The idea here, of course, is to move from doubt to conviction. And this long-term goal, of course, is for us to take an unshakable refuge in the teacher and the teachings. Okay, so you guys, I haven't really said much within any depth here, but do you have any questions about the material so far? Yes, Ben.
Just two things. In those different levels of Lamrim, where do foundational qualities and songs of experience
Okay,
fit into that?
so in those three texts of Lama Song, none of them are those Lamrims.
Right.
Those are two other Lamrims that he also wrote, but these are like, oh, what's great about it, there are only 14 verses that are one page of paper and you can memorize it. So those other three previous Lamrims, then what they would do is you get the 16, what's it, how many verses did I say? 45 verses. And you'd memorize the 45 verses, right? That's what they call short Lamrim. These other ones are sort of like verse poems. The whole Lamrim's in there, of course. But in a different way. So you don't see in there these three terms, they're not obvious.
It's just a comment. When I first did my first Lamrim in 2008, just went right through the greatness of the teacher and greatness of the teaching. I thought, why can't I remember this? And last year, when I was going through extreme doubt, it hit me as like, oh, now I understand why that's so important.
That's right. That's exactly right, Ben. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So I've used the AI to create some questions. Right? And so one of the questions is, how do the three greatnesses create a stable environment for learning? So first of all, they build respect for the source, the method, and the process of listening. That's its purpose, right? So like I say, so with respect, then you don't have doubt. And so it's respect and to be clear of doubts.
It's authentic to you.
That's right. Yeah, it's the idea to have some sort of sense of authenticity. And of these three greatnesses, the question is, why is the author's biography considered the first greatness of the teaching? And just like you said, Ian, it proves the lineage is authentic and the teacher has actualized the goals. So in those days when they came out to be a teacher, when I read what you have to be a teacher, you say, I can't do that. I'm definitely not a teacher. And so I wouldn't even use the name teacher. I thought, no, I'll call myself a tutor because that's what I could actually help, but I don't have the qualities of the teacher. I went to see like an authentic teacher explain this to him, and then he said, okay, Eddie, if you just take these things and do them, that's enough for me. So I'll try to keep those standards. So here we'll start off with Lama Rinpoche's text first, and we've just got one verse here. And this is called verse two. And like I said, the text begins with the preliminaries. There's a homage and a summary. This verse is the summary. And it says, understand there are three kinds of person because of their small, middling, and supreme capacities. I shall write clearly, distinguishing their individual characteristics. Then, as you said, that the main section goes, okay, here's one verse on those of small capacities, one verse on those of middling capacity, and here's 65 verses on those of great capacity. You can see the text is primarily for those of great capacity. In other words, it's a Mahayana text. It's a text for those who wish to become enlightened to benefit of all beings. Now, you can see this because of their small, middling, and supreme capacities. Now, this text is set out, all the Lamanjit texts are set out like this. So you might think, oh, there are three different types of people. But in fact, the capacity all relates to one sort of person, like us. If you start here, it's sort of saying, look, you want to like climb to the top, you have to start at the bottom one. And that's called a person of small capacity. Then as you start climbing up, you get up halfway up the ladder, now you're in middling capacity. Right? And you keep going, and now you're at the top. So those of small capacity, the teaching from there, their whole purpose is for us to actually appreciate what we've got. So this life you've got, like, appreciate it. You can do marvelous things with it. And this is what it shows you at the beginning. Right? If for the person of middling capacities, here he describes that we need to develop a wish for freedom from our destructive mental habits. And thirdly, we are to extend that wish for freedom that we have for ourselves to everyone else and help them become free. That's the person's great capacity. So the next few slides, we're going to look at the initial level of this practitioner. We look at what they aim for, what they practice to sort of achieve that aim, and also what they practice to independence upon having that aim. In other words, it's also like we need to develop a motivation of small capacity. And so how do you do that? So this is what I'm going to explain next, how to develop the motivation of a person of small capacity. And once we have the motivation, what do we do? So then there's the practices that follow the motivation of a person of small capacity. So the first thing, for the first, what we have, what we've done, a person of small capacity, their direct aim is fortunate rebirth. Now we have to all, this is, like I said, yesterday one said to me, if we don't achieve this, we've wasted this life. We're really in trouble if we don't achieve a fortunate rebirth. Now, what do we practice once we have this idea? What does the person of small capacity actually practice? It is to pacify the coarse, harmful thoughts, words, and deeds, and to replace them with the 10 virtuous minds. So the main point for a beginner is to secure a peaceful future. Conceptually, we have to understand that our current choices shape our next experience. And analytically, we observe that helpful actions lead to happiness, while harmful ones lead to pain. And to succeed in achieving this fortunate rebirth, we have to take a safe direction by trusting in proven guides of wisdom. And like I said, we have to eliminate the 10 harmful habits, we'll pacify them and then eliminate them, and by replacing them with the 10 virtues. So 10 non-virtues. So what do we meditate upon, or what do we have to become familiar with? What ideas do we need to cultivate to achieve this direct aim? Well, that's what we're going to look at next. So The meditations that lead to the motivation at this level are to first of all know what a precious human life is. You know, it was where I'm in for fortunate rebirth. That's a good thing. But yeah, what leads to the motivation to achieve that goal? Well, we find out what it means to have this present life, but how valuable it is, what we can achieve with it. We meditate upon precious human life, death and impermanence, and unfortunate rebirth. Again, the motivation is, of course, to have a fortunate rebirth. Now, once we have this motivation, our purpose now is to go, well, I have to achieve a fortunate rebirth. But I see I can, because of a lot of good stuff going on for me. So what do I do once I acknowledge, wow, I'm one of those people that have a fortunate human rebirth, and I know that I could die tonight or any time. I know for certain I'll die. I just don't know when. And I'm not quite sure right now what's going to happen to me after I die. So having this fortunate human rebirth, what do I do once I know I've got it? So here we take refuge in the three jewels and observe the law of karma and its effect. So in other words, we're sort of asking ourselves, you know, acknowledging that we are living and that we are going to die, and it's uncertain about what happens next. We're asking ourselves, how do we ensure safety and happiness when this life ends? And we know the quality of our future depends entirely on the actions and motivations that drive it today. So by meditating on the fragility of life and the rarity of our current freedom, we lose interest in trivial distractions. We realize that death is certain, this time it is not. And this creates a sort of healthy sense of urgency to find a safe direction and align our behavior with the law of ethical cause and effect. You know, like I said, once you work out that it's your own actions of mind in particular that cause problems for us in this life, and these problems, the consequences of what we do in this life can carry on for quite some time. You know? In fact, if I look back at my life and look at some of the stupid things I do, have done, and I know that some of the consequences haven't caught up with me, right? I've been lucky, so to speak. But it's there, right? There are people that know what I used to do and have done, and they know they still want me for things, right? So the consequences are still there. This is just like karma, cause and effect, right? These are things I did in this world that were silly and unskillful. But it's the same with us. We do unskillful things. They won't all ripen in this life. We don't meet all the consequences in this life. We might meet them later, in the between state between this life and another life, or in the next life. But the consequences will arise unless we stop them. And we can stop them by taking refuge and acting upon karmic cause and result. So it's not certain, like I said, it's not certain that I'll experience the consequences of my actions in this life, because I can do something about it. And if I do something about it, then the consequences will be quite either diminished or be experienced in a very slight sort of a way. The full impact won't be felt by me, in other words. And it won't be. I'll tell you that now. Why? Because I know about Dharma. So if they even come to me and grab me on the shoulder, I would not behave like people normally would. So I go, of course, this is the consequence of my past behavior. I stick my hand up for it. Just cause and effect.
Can I ask, you said it could be in between lives.
That's right.
So yeah. Is that in Bada?
Yeah.
So how does karma affect you in Bada?
It's cause and effect. It's internal cause and effect. So the body is not something that will appear to you as something separate from the mind, just like it does now, right?
Yeah.
Like the world seems separate to the mind. So when you're in the body, all your experiences, it's just like that. So that's what they say.
Still
of your past life. Yeah, that's right, karma. That's
and
right.
I'll be frightening.
Yeah.
If they're bad.
If they're bad. That's why it's so important to die with a calm and virtuous mind.
So if it's frightening, does that mean that no matter what we've done in this life, in the Bardo, and it's frightening and negativity, does that mean that you may not have fortunately?
Yeah, for sure. That's right. That's what I'm saying. Why it's so important to die with a positive mind, because that, at least that mind will be a cause for the next few moments. And they're the moments when you're going to find yourself in the intermediate state. So if you go into it with a positive mind, then the appearances are positive. Just like that.
So it's really all hanging on that moment of death.
Yeah.
Like that's what is really, is that what we're working for?
Yeah, that's right. This is this solid episode. Like, okay, we've got this wonderful opportunity. We've got this life. If we know that, and you go, oh my gosh, I can save myself from the lower realms.
Huh.
That's the idea. And go, and what? How does it save the Buddhist teachings on cause and effect? Virtue produces happiness. Non-virtue produces suffering. So at the time of death, if fear arises or non-virtue or killing or anything, like there's a cause for suffering. Next one will be suffering. And because here the mind is very subtle, right? It's like your whole world is like, it can't stop it. Right? It's just cause and effect. So we get lots and lots of methods in the Dharma to wait for, to work at that moment. That's why it's not so much about this life. If you're working at this life, it's then, well, you've got to do everything good to prepare for what's going to come. That's as well as huge impetus put on having a virtuous mind, a positive virtuous mind. And because we don't know when we're going to leave this life, right? You want to have a, you want to have a virtuous mind as often as possible. Yeah. So last week, this week, I think I was talking about the class about rejoicing. Yeah. This is the easiest and simplest way to create a virtuous mind, is to rejoice in the good that anyone has done. That you have done, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas have done, whoever has done it. So now I remember when we were at Newmarket, and I walk into the centre, and across the road was another couple walking. You know, and I was going to the centre. I thought, "Oh, thank goodness they don't throw stones at me." You know, oh, I rejoice in their virtue. How wonderful! Because you know, there's plenty of places all around the world where people are throwing stones at you, and a lot worse than that too. So it's not happening here. So I rejoice in it not happening here. And he, oh, thank goodness we're in Australia. But in the Dharma Centre, right there, I'm going towards it. This is fantastic because you know how rare this is in the world, right? You're not going to find Dharma Centres in most countries in Africa, in the Middle East. In many, many, many countries, there's no place that when they're teaching you about how to basically control your mind and become a virtuous person. So at the moment, I'm visiting a couple of people who are dying at the moment. They're not Buddhists. Well, one's a Buddhist, one's not. But it's quite interesting watching what's going on. Okay? And so this is a little story that I read. I thought, man, that's just like that. Okay? This is an ancient carver spent years chipping a stone into a perfect square. And when a friend asked why, he said, well, to make it pretty, to make it look great. He says, and then when asked what he would do next, he said, I'll throw it away. So many of us work just as hard for things we cannot keep. And this is what I'm finding with sitting with these guys, right? Like all the stuff you did, you can't keep, take a skeleton of it with you. It's like the sort of thing you'll die, right? It's like, what the heck was the point of my life? A lot of people ask that question, like, what have I done? You'd hope you've got a good answer there, eh? Because if you don't, it's like you most likely think, I've done nothing or I've wasted it or a lot of regret. And that's not the type of mind to go into at the time of death. That's like guilt, regret, all that sort of stuff, right? Not good. But each of us should look and go, now, what can I find? You know, like I've done something valuable, surely, in this life. And we could say, well, yeah, I've tried my best to create virtue. in whatever way, and hold on to it. So in many of the stages of the path, you know, one of the great things about being alive on the teacher or guru devotion, I look at this and I look at the old stories of the Catholic priests coming in and trying to convert people at the very last moment to become a Catholic. At one stage, I really didn't like that. I thought it was really odd. Now I don't. I think, thank goodness you guys did. Wonderful. In fact, it doesn't, at this stuff, we don't need to know anything about emptiness. Here, we just need to be virtuous people and understand that, yes, we will be grasping and clinging to the virtue. Well, guess what that will create? A good rebirth. Right? So we'll find ourselves in the cycle of existence with a good rebirth, and we can continue to practice. So basically knowing that actions have, we need to walk away from these classes knowing that actions have consequences which go beyond this life. Yeah, in fact, you know, like if you know this, if you really take this to heart and think about your own dying and what might happen, you don't want to be thinking there about the bad stuff you've done and you never said sorry for, stuff you've never let go of. So in fact, when I went through this, I thought about this and ended up picking the phone up and ringing up New Zealand and saying sorry to the different people that I'd hurt and the stupid things I did. That was it. Because I didn't want to, I thought, yeah, I might just start thinking about that if I'm on my deathbed. Jeez, I don't want to think about that. I'll clear it up now. And it has. And I said, like, yeah, I can just let that go now. Now, I don't need to feel guilty about it. I just didn't know what to do. I just wanted to be happy. I just thought if I did these things, I'd be happy. And I was wrong. Because, you know, you hurt people, I understand it's easier, it's better off to go and say, look, I'm sorry. If they've passed away, just get that sense of regret now and let it go. In fact, one of the things I read about the Tibetans saying, Westerners do it really different than Tibetans. In fact, many of Westerners feel so guilty, they really hang on to that part. They look at that of all the bad things they did. The Tibetans skate really quickly over that and just go, rejoice that I've invested. Because it's the positive mind you want, not the one that's looking back at regret and negativity in that. You do that, but then you don't like, let it go. Come back up to service, give yourself another shot. Now, so knowing that actions have consequences beyond this life, this is the first thing to develop certainty in. And then reasoning that since life is short, we have to prioritize what lasts. So the thing that really lasts when we try to make stable is realization, so that we can carry it from this life into the intermediate state and have the power of that produce a good rebirth. In terms of meditation, there's a number of different things you can do. But one is to sort of really feel the preciousness of this life that we have and then how it could go like at any minute, any second. This really brings about a sense of urgency to practice, to do good, to keep the mind, you know, focused on the things. Remember, we don't know when we're going to die. People that look really healthy could just keel over just like that, and they do. So what can we do practically? Well, I've been thinking about this, and I think about how we often hurt people. It's really always, in my case at least, through my speech. So if you're going out there hitting people and killing animals, which you're probably not, we're not running around stealing things. And we're probably not engaged, you know, trying to rip off people, being sexually unskillful. But before, none of those things will affect us. But harsh speech could, and idle speech could, and divisive speech could in line. But they're the things that we could do that. So there's the place to go, okay, so now, maybe when you find yourself in difficult situations, with you know, you get emotional, just shut your mouth. Give yourself, like, breathe a few breaths, take a few breaths before you speak. Because right there, it's like, is this speech, am I speaking trying to benefit the person, or am I actually saying something that's going to hurt them? So we need to ask ourselves that question, like, before we speak. And believe me, it's very hard not to speak harshly when others have spoken unskillfully tough, isn't it? In this life, I must have really quick to go, I want to say something. In fact, there's a person who says to me, stop being so defensive anymore.
Yeah.
It's quite true, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's
enough. That's what we say, oh, you're quite right, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
And that's what we should say, right?
Yeah.
That's good.
I was going to say, sometimes I think that kicking rush out, you actually have to get used to the feeling of the sting.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, you know that line in Pulp Fiction when he says you've got to go down in the fourth, and he says you might feel a slight sting. That's just pride, fucking with you. It's like you've got to feel what that feels like because it's so easy. You just got to hold it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Feel it.
He's got to like have that pause and the.
But you feel it. You feel the sting. Yeah. It's like it's hard not to react.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been looking at the spin. I've been looking at some of the techniques that you can use, right? So the first thinking says is like observe what actually takes place, right? And then he says feel it. And when you feel it, then the next one says, so what do you need? What's this feeling telling you? And then lastly, finish off with like a request that you make, either to the person who you're trying to understand, or it works. I've been trying it out and going, wow, this is such a great way. So instead of, if you look at how you actually behave, like it's just sort of saying, look, before you just start talking, observe what actually happened here. What actually happened?
But there's also an advantage because people sometimes say things to you to manipulate you, to get you to respond in a certain way.
That's right.
And they'll use that. So it's actually smart not to just respond.
That's right.
Want you to
not
to take the bait.
So
not taking the bait, you can do that by observing what's actually taking place and explaining it to yourself in the most neutral language you can. And then go, so what does it feel like when they spoke like this? And like right there, right? So that feeling, that's our responsibility, right? They're not doing that to us. This is karma working now. You heard this, the voice, what you heard the person say, that's the condition. And here, another condition arises in response to it. Now, what are you going to do? So you've got to ask yourself, right? Is it going to be harmful or is it going to be peaceful? Harmful or useful? Harmful, peaceful? Which one? If it's harm, you're going to hurt yourself. That's the first thing that's going to happen. You've just created a new cause for your own suffering. It's completely uncertain whether your harmful speech will actually hurt the other person. They might be like insane, right? Like, oh, beauty, gotcha. and they don't get all upset. It's like, gotcha, now I'll say something else to get you. Yeah. In fact, this is what I used to do. Well, sometimes I'm in wars, I take it my, it's battle. And if I can throw you off, I'm going to. I know they're doing it to me too. But here, it's like, this is what the great thing about the Dharma is. It is non-aggressive. And my way of being in the world before I came, quite aggressive. Always, it's like I'm going to fight for my life. But this is just my perception. It's not like that actually at all. Now, if you perceive it that way, that's the world you're in. But again, karma, cause and effect. You see the world as a battlefield, you're going to approach it as such and do all the things that you need to win your victories. If you see it in some other way, like for instance, wow, all these people are just like walking wounds. They're all suffering, just like me. What can I do? Today's bumping up against them because it's going to hurt me too. What can I do instead? So, we try and shift our view. Yes, in practice, deliberately stop yourself before saying something unkind. And like I said, you'll get notice of it because of the way you feel. Right? So it's like if you pay attention to your feeling, you'll know if it's a really uncomfortable feeling, you're going to I'll breathe it out first, and maybe take a couple more breaths and say, just a moment. You know, I feel overwhelmed. I don't want to respond like this. I need to take a couple of breaths. Right? Just explain what's going on, how I feel. Right? And the other thing is, like, and if you forget this and actually end up at Samadhi Bhati, you're going to need about 20 minutes to recover. Yeah, all longer. Yeah. And in that recovery phase, you've got to stop thinking about what just happened. Otherwise, you're going to need another 20, longer. Well, no, because you say, no, that's an effect. And the effect is disintegrating from this moment onwards. In fact, that's how the Tibetans look at it. They go, these feelings are, you could say, and there's lots of ways you can look at it, but one way you can, is they often go, this is the effect of karma. Yes, it feels unpleasant, but that's because the cause was unpleasant. Wow. And you created the cause, right? The other person's language is just a condition. So by you hurting others, but now not hurting, the hurt goes out. You don't cling to it or anything like that, and don't take it up again, because otherwise you will create a new karma. We don't, you know, like I said, this idea of like looking around the room, it's not a bad idea to think that. You know, I don't want to create more harm for myself.
Is that beautiful?
Yeah, this one's where it's very useful to ask yourself, like, what do I need? This response here, like, what do I need to do here? Yeah. And sometimes it takes quite some time to do this, but this is much more valuable time than you opening up your mouth really early in the piece and just escalating the whole conflict. It's much better to be quiet for a while, just like you're saying. You say to your partner, just a moment, I'm just trying to work it out. I'm just trying to work out my part in it. I'm trying to work on my part in this conversation. Just give me a few minutes. So you're going to have feelings, like the feelings, right? So that's an effect of karma. It is an effect of karma. If you act on that feeling through your body or speech or mind, now you create new karma. But that's what we don't want to do. We don't want to create new negative karma. And like if you don't, and just let it flow, we release. We don't cling to it. Ben?
Well, when you have that feeling, why does it feel good to react? Not good, but why does it...
It's a release.
Well, that's right. It's a release, but it's an unskillful release. Because you just create more suffering.
Mm.
You can release skillfully or unskillfully. Up to you. Now, once you know this...
It's not intuitive.
Of course, the intuitive thing is to respond to harm with harm.
Yeah, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't
get
it at all.
Not at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I was speaking to somebody telling. So here's my first question to you. Is it selfish to only seek a good rebirth for yourself? So the answer is it's a vital foundation. You cannot save others while you are drowning. And the example they give you is like being on a plane, like putting on your own oxygen mask before you help your neighbor. They tell you, doesn't it? Put your own oxygen, otherwise you can't help. It's the same. You don't get a fortune human rebirth, you can't help anyone. It's not what you could normally call self from the Mahayana point. Yes, yeah, really selfish. But from the beginner perspective, not at all. Not at all.
Depends on the
scope. If you look up there, of course, you go, yes, once I was very selfish. You wouldn't say those people are selfish. You'd say, once I was selfish. I only cared about my own welfare. But now I see, those other practices come up in the middling scope and the great scope. Here it's just like, acknowledge you're drowning. You need to save yourself. Yeah, you're in the water, you haven't drowned yet. So what are we going to do? Yeah, well, you better look after yourself, you better make sure you float. It's only then that you're in a position to really sort of help others. So that's not selfish.
It's responsible.
Yeah, it's being able to respond from what you're capable of doing. If you're capable of much more, and you were just about yourself, yeah, you'd say, yeah, it's selfish. This person would have done much more for others, but they didn't. So from that perspective, you say it's selfish. Here's the second one. If actions have results, who is the true architect of your future?
You are.
We are. That's right. We are. And this is like a painter. You know, when you get painters, like they look up at the canvas they've got it on. Who decides what colours go where?
They do.
The artists. Yeah. So it's us, right? We make the decisions over what we're going to do and why we're doing it. And the teachings will come, cause and effect, tell you what those effects will be. So that we can look at them and go, oh my gosh, the things I thought I used to be able to do to make me happy, oh my gosh, they got terrible consequences. I had no idea. I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't do this other thing. Let's do our first meditation. Your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed. Just allow your mind to become vast and quiet. And then undertake this meditation with an altruistic intention to transform your habits so that you may eventually become a source of benefit for all beings. Now, have you ever considered that the true measure of a life is how well you prepare for the journey beyond this present moment? The true measure of a life is how well you have prepared for the journey beyond this present moment. The theme of the path for the beginner is the shift from worldly obsession to an ethical concern for your future state through the power of mindfulness. In other words, we need to remember what to abandon and what to adopt. Now, ignoring the reality of our mortality leads to a wasted life, while embracing it empowers us to live with a profound purpose and clarity. Because our time here is truly like a lightning flash. Brilliant and powerful in the moment, it's gone before you can even grasp its fading light. So why must we, or why should we acknowledge our mortality? We want to acknowledge our mortality to realize that this life is as fragile as a drop of dew on a summer week. It's ready to vanish at any second. So I wonder, where will we find true protection from future suffering? Well, we find it by turning towards reliable spiritual guidance. So how do we actually transform our future? Meticulously align your actions with virtue, knowing that your deeds will follow you like the shadow follows your body on a bright and sunny day. And carry this awareness to each moment of the day, letting the law of cause and effect guide every small choice you make with integrity. And then rest in the quiet confidence that a life built on ethical discipline is a life that can never be truly lost. And exhaling, and inhaling, and open your eyes, and moving on. In this section are these three preliminaries: is the greatness of the author, the greatness of the teachings, how to listen to and explain the teachings. And in that section, there's a part on the meditation session. This is the big labyrinths. So meditation is basically a systematic method for mental training. And its purpose is to make the mind serviceable, transform it from a source of distraction into a tool for peace and clarity. So the main thing to take away from this is meditation is a process of familiarizing the mind with constructive ways of thinking. And it functions through two gears, stabilizing and investigation. So just try and look at meditation as a sort of mental habit building. We use reasoning to see why our current stresses are temporary. And one of the meditations we can do is just practice resting in the feeling of kindness. Practical terms is like, I said, take three deep breaths before answering perhaps a difficult phone call. Or if you're in a difficult conversation, your energy will want you to come out quickly and respond. You have to sort of ignore that, knowing that, no, that's not the way to go. Just feel it, breathe. Breathe again. Take a few breaths. If the other person looks a little agitated because you're taking time, explain to them, I just need a few moments to think about this. You know, I'm feeling quite stressed out, actually, so I just need to calm down before I can respond. So just explain it, and it'll give you even more time, more resources. So, okay, let's do a very simple meditation again. We're just going to do like a couple of minutes. So here, just on the in-breath, just breathe in. On the out-breath, exhale and think, may I be helpful. And just keep doing this. Out-breath, may I be helpful. May I be helpful, may I be useful. If your mind wanders, just bring it back to the same. May I be helpful? May I be mindful? May I be useful? And just let that go. So meditation, a proper meditation, is not about stopping thoughts, but about choosing which thoughts to adopt and to become familiar with them. So you work out thoughts that produce suffering for yourself because your actions will follow. And go and recognize, no, that's not useful. And choosing which thought to follow, which thought to adopt. Okay, now let's look at Lama Tsongkhapa's foundation. So this is just about a quarter of an hour ago. And we'll look at this text because this is the text we'll be discussing over the next few weeks. So again, Lama Tsongkhapa's text has got the foundation's got preliminaries, two verses. Then there are 10 verses that talk about the teaching. So you can see there's only two verses for those of small capacity, two verses for those of middling capacity, and 6 verses for those of great capacity. And then at the very end is a request and a prayer. The three principal aspects of the path is very similar. It's also got 14 verses, but it's set out a little slightly different than this. And in that text, we're really not looking so much at the three scopes, but about the three principal aspects of the path. So the three principal aspects of the path, we're looking at how to generate renunciation in bodhicitta and then the correct view. Here it's set out as like, what do you do as a beginner? What do you do in the middle? What do you do at the end? And this is sort of difference, what each text is trying to do. So Lama Tsongkhapa begins his text by saying this. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Correctly devoting to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, he's blessed me to rely upon him with a great respect. Now, the objective here is for us to recognize the spiritual teacher as the primary source of all internal progress. Now, this is incredibly important as the beginner, right? We're looking outwardly at somebody and we're like, we're just, I don't know, you know, so you know. And then we ask them, okay, that's what we're going to be hearing. But how am I meant to like, think of them? What am I meant to do there? And there it says, look, adopt the view that your teacher is an actual Buddha. This is not easy to do. And when you come to the text, this is a big topic. There's even books written on this whole thing of how to do this correctly. There are many ways people have gone wrong with this topic, and boy, big mess. Especially for them, it's terrible for them if you get this, if you approach this in the wrong way. And people have approached it in the wrong way, and that's what happened. So to stop that happening, I always recommend Berzin's book, How to Relate to a Spiritual Teacher. All the ways you can go wrong are explained very straightforwardly and succinctly, and what you're actually trying to do, how these practices came into, you know, being and all that sort of stuff. I think it's a fantastic book.
Sorry, who was the author?
Berzin?
Berzin.
What's his first name?
Alexander,
thank you. Dr. Alexander Berzin. Yeah. That is a fantastic book for anyone to study how to relate to a teacher. This book. And so I remember kids always say, saying, so it says, you know, the foundation of all the things kind of is the work of the root of the path. So I guess it is to say, it is not the teacher. This is the place that you could get this wrong. He says, it is not the teacher that is the source of all your developments. You might read it now, he says, it's not. He says, it's the relationship you develop with the teacher that creates all the good stuff. Yeah? So one of the best ways you can relate to the teacher, the very best way is to see them as the Buddha. And what people have got really wrong here is to take this literally. Now, the reason for doing this is to see your teacher as a Buddha. Tell me, so what do other people know about this topic? Why? Why should we see the teacher as a Buddha? How does that advantage us? What's good for us?
It means we can accept the teachings as an end. True authentic
and
worth listening to.
Yeah. Anything else? Ben?
Benefits our own mind.
Yes, it does. I'm just asking like how.
By projecting good qualities onto that object.
Yeah, the major reason is here for if you look at it as a Buddha, right, they're enlightened. Buddhas do not have any bad qualities. Yes, if you don't look at them, what are you going to look for? The mistakes, the way they look, you're going to find all sorts of ways to criticize them, to find fault in them. So this stops that, and that's the point. You will not look at the teacher in a negative way, which it means, because if you do, guess who it harms? It doesn't make any difference to the teacher, does it? It makes a lot of difference to you, though, to us. And so it sort of nips that in the bud. And of course, the major way to do this, I'll tell you this because this is a, when I was doing this practice, like nothing was happening for years, right? And I've gone, there's something wrong because I don't have the feeling of guru devotion that I know other people have. So why? So, of course, you know, I go back to the text and start reading it sentence by sentence, trying to figure out what am I not doing, which I should be doing, or what am I doing that I should not be doing? It's kind of something from my side, isn't it? Stop the text when other people have all developed these good qualities. I'm able to say, it says, recollect the kindness of your teacher. As soon as you do that, like you think about the kindness of anybody, don't your whole way of being towards them change? Yeah. And so this is the thing. So, okay, recollect that first. Yeah. And then you sort of build on to finally see, wow, in fact, they were just like the Buddha. Aren't they doing the same things the Buddha would have done? You did for 45 years? I'm sure he is. Yeah. And then you sort of go through the process and you know whether he is a Buddha or not. In fact, I don't know. But if I would take to the position, I think, well, I'm gonna, even though I don't know, and it's great benefit for me to think he is. So I'm going to. That's all that's required of me. And of course, like I said, Berzin's book points out how you can do this and how you can go wrong. And if you sort of go back and look over the last 20 years of all the Western students who went wrong, you will know, God, I don't want to ever do that. I don't want that sort of problem. If we can avoid all that. And Lama Tsongkhapa says in the second verse, understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. Now, this is like, you know, you look at those other teachings on fortunate human rebirth. This is the verse that just deals with that. Now, the idea is for you to discover how precious, how rare and valuable this life is that you've got. If you have this life as a human being and you meet the 10 conditions and the 8 freedoms, and you do this, right, then contrast your life with thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, oh my God, I got something really exceptional here, really exceptional. And if I don't take advantage of it, well, I've got it. It'll go like that. As we all know, death can come at any moment. Well, in fact, you know, when I'm in a car on the highway, you know, you don't have to do anything wrong here to die. You do everything right, still die.
So it's sort of a combination.
Okay, question about this verse.
Yeah.
Maybe this is just a translation.
Yeah.
I'm saying precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once.
Yeah. So that cannot be taken literally. What you're saying there is like, I know now, and that's the one time.
That's the one time.
I've got it.
We can have more.
Oh, yeah. In fact, you should think, I've had them before, because if I didn't have them before, how the heck would I get this one?
Yeah.
And that virtue was created. And so here I am again. But it could all go. I don't want it to all go. Yeah, so this part here is not to be taken literally, and that's why we often have teachers to break it down, because it often looks like take it literally.
So it is still pretty rare, is the point of it, isn't it? Like,
yeah, yes, it's incredibly rare. But like I said, if you just take this famous only once, you go, well, this is it.
Yeah.
And then you're not going to get another one, are you?
No.
Because this
but
is the once.
So this rebirth only once. The precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once, the one that's brought you here today to this place with 2 legs, 2 arms and a brain and whatever else it needed to get here and listen. Yeah, it's this rebirth. But you might be deaf or blind.
I always thought it was a metaphor for saying that it's quite rare. Like,
But it is very rare, isn't it?
There's quite a number of different ways you can take this, but the one is never ever think it's just one time out of billions of lifetimes I've had, or 10,000 lifetimes, and this is it. And I'm never going to get another one. Yeah, that doesn't make sense. Yeah.
But you'll never get this one again.
No, this one's on and going out as we live it. Now, so what is the essence of the slide? To have freedom to develop the mind through the study and practice of Dharma and achieve, like I said, a perfect human rebirth, liberation from cyclic existence or Buddhahood. But the first one is freedom from the lower realms so that we do not find ourselves with something less than what we've got. Yeah, so right now, if you have these eight freedoms and 10 endowments, you do have the freedom to develop your mind. That's what it's saying. If you meet these conditions, you have it. So how do we differentiate a precious human rebirth from a human rebirth? Because they're not the same. They're quite different. There are many people who have a human rebirth, but they don't have a precious human rebirth. So what makes a difference? Well, you know that you have a precious human rebirth and not just a human rebirth. If you have all those conditions in place, the conditions are there, you got it. The other lovely thing is, if you find only one or two conditions are not there, you can get them. This is what I found when I was in New Zealand. There were nearly all there, but there was no Dharma teacher there. There was a whole lot that was missing. Then I came over here, and 20 years later, there I am. They all came together. I met a Dharma teacher. I met the Sangha. So then all the conditions came. So you can get them. But sometimes you don't have them all at once, but that's okay. So, okay, what do I actually need to make it precious, really valuable? So we find what those are and we get them. But again, this leads us to what's interesting. So do you have any questions at all? The conditions to attain one of the Buddhist goals are present. Right? So the first goal that we are seeking is to not take rebirth in the lower realms and take rebirth in the upper realms, especially as a human being with leisure and opportunity to engage in our practice again. That's the first goal. Right? This is the goal of anybody who begins the path. That's their first goal. Now, you think this through, you're going to go, yeah, but I'm going to have to do this all again. You go, yeah. You know, yeah, difficult was to get all this together. Yeah, I know, it wasn't pleasant either. It took me a long time. Yeah, that's right. Same thing could happen again. Is that what you want? And even if you get it again, guess what? You want to do it again? Yeah. And then you're going to go, actually, no. Well, is there any way to stop this round and round, the cycling? Yeah. You can break out altogether. So that's the second goal. Complete freedom from this cycle of continuous rebirth with the cycle of uncontrolled rebirth. Cycle of existence. Yeah, okay, well, it's great that I'm free, but what about my brothers and sisters, the people I love? What about them? I don't know them. Is there something I can do? Yeah. You could become a Buddha. Yeah, so there's our three goals. Buddhahood for all beings, personal liberation for your own welfare, or fortunate human rebirth to escape rebirth in the lower realms. Okay, so let's do our final meditation. Again, exhale, let your mind become vast as a clear sky, the body relax completely. And then dedicate this meditation to the ultimate benefit of all living beings. In order to sit through this meditation, may I become enlightened to bring all beings to enlightenment. So now imagine that every virtue that you admire began as a seed planted in perfect, fertile soil. Now, Tsongkhapa teaches that devotion to the teacher and valuing your life are the foundation of all excellence. Now, without these roots, spiritual growth remains fragile and easily slipped away by worldly distractions. And I think of yourself as being a great gardener. And see your inner masterpiece as a wonderful garden which will come into being because you've removed all the weeds and obstructions and the obstacles and doubts. Now, why is reliance on the spiritual teacher the first step towards achieving our inner transformation? So the spiritual teacher provides the discipline needed to reveal our own magnificent and hidden potential. A teacher can provide the vision and skill needed to refine the mind we presently possess. So how significant is this human life compared to all other possible forms of existence? This life is like a rarer vessel with the capacity to achieve complete and lasting liberation. It is as improbable as a blind turtle surfacing from the bottom of the ocean every 100 years and having its head enter the inner circle of a ring floating in the ocean. And what creates the stability needed to ensure that our spiritual progress remains steady and unshakable? There's consistent focus on these foundational teachings, reliance upon the teacher, fortunate human rebirth, death and impermanence and the sufferings of the lower realms. These foundational truths, focusing upon them, build the strength required for every higher path. So to ensure that we do have a higher realm rebirth and that we do not find ourselves in the lower realms, we need to rely upon an authentic teacher, listen to their advice, and put it into practice. And what will their advice be? To live in harmony with the Buddhist teachings of karmic cause and effect. To adopt the teachings of internal mental cause and effect. So decide to do this. I've got to actually discipline the mind. It's the mind that creates suffering when it's undisciplined. But if I can discipline it, I'll experience happiness. And the discipline is not harsh, it's gentle. It's non-aggressive. The thing is, I'll be patient and non-aggressive towards myself and others. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale, and let your eyes flutter open. And that gets us to the end of our class tonight. So you know that there are those three preliminary teachings, right? Greatness of the author, the greatness of the teachings, and then I have to listen to and explain the teachings. And you know that what's the aim of the beginning? The first beginnings, what's the goal here?
Freedom from the lower realms.
Freedom from the lower realms. It's a fortunate human rebirth. You must avoid the lower realms and achieve the rebirth state as a human being with the leisure and opportunity to engage again. But we have it now. You're here, you got it. But if you look at him, you go, my gosh, I'm one of those people. You might look at him and go, like, for me, it took 40 years. To find it was the same with his mother. 40-something years before you find your path and go, wow, this suits me. All the conditions are there. Wow. I'm done for it. Here are the first two verses of this foundation. They dealt with guru devotion and fortunate human rebirth. For you guys, if you have access to any information, any material on guru devotion and fortunate human rebirth, have a look at it, but also know that these two topics. Yeah, we teach whole courses on these two topics. So if you don't find it, it's okay. But do have a look at the foundation of all good qualities. See if you can memorize these next two verses, as we'll be talking about them next week. So let's just dedicate the energy we're putting into this class. And join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. The next one. May the Supreme Dual Bhagavad Chita get born, arise, and die. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as the space remains, as long as the sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. In the prayer for his holiness' long life, the wish granted, the wish fulfilling dual, source of every single benefit and happiness of this world, to the incomparably kind King Gatsa, I beseech. May all your holiness and things be fulfilled. And finally, for the successful filing of Rinpoche's reincarnation in swift return. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings for exhalation and purpose, you wore the armor of patience as never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request. Okay, so thank you, everybody. And my apologies for the coughing and sputtering and all that stuff. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.